I am Link. Welcome to Tech Talk, a Black Elk Media production. Today is March 29, 2026, and we're tracking the latest shifts in the digital landscape. OpenAI built one of the most capable video generation systems ever demonstrated, and then they shut it down. Sora, the model that turned text prompts into cinematic video, is gone. Not pivoted, not rebranded, killed. The question worth asking isn't just why, it's what OpenAI learned about the economics of generative video that made them walk away from a product the entire industry was racing to copy. Because when a company with billions in compute infrastructure decides a flagship product isn't worth running, that tells you something about the gap between what's technically impressive and what's actually sustainable. The costs, the copyright exposure, the compute demands per generation, at some point, the math stopped working. Today we're pulling apart that math. We're looking at what Sora actually cost to operate, why the competitive landscape shifted underneath it, and what this signals about which AI products survive, and which ones were always just expensive demos. The front page. Here's your rapid-fire briefing on what's moving in tech right now. Story 1. IBM just cleared a major bar in quantum computing. Their quantum processor simulated the magnetic behavior of a real material, and the results matched actual lab data. Not approximations, not close enough. A direct match with neutron scattering experiments on a real magnetic compound. The co-author at Los Alamos called it the most impressive alignment he's ever seen between qubit simulation and experimental measurement. What makes this significant? Quantum computers have long promised to model quantum systems that classical machines can only approximate. This is concrete evidence that promise is starting to deliver. If the trajectory holds, the implications reach into superconductor design, battery chemistry, and pharmaceutical development. Areas where better simulation translates directly into better physical outcomes. Story 2. From simulating matter to actually reaching it. NASA announced its first nuclear-powered interplanetary spacecraft, designated SR-1 Freedom, targeting a 2028 launch to Mars. The craft will carry a fleet of small helicopters, successors to Ingenuity, called Skyfall. But unlike Ingenuity, which was purely a tech demo, these have real mission objectives, scouting landing sites for future human missions, and using ground-penetrating radar to map subsurface water ice deposits. The nuclear fission reactor stays dormant on the ground and only activates in space. And here's the interesting detail. NASA may keep the spacecraft flying deeper into the solar system after it deploys the helicopters. Nuclear power solves the energy constraint that limits solar-dependent missions. And that changes the math on what's reachable. Story 3. Now, speaking of things that are harder to control than expected, Reuters is reporting that four Chinese universities, including two with direct ties to the People's Liberation Army, purchased Supermicro servers containing NVIDIA A100 chips, despite active U.S. export controls. Public procurement documents show purchases completed in 2025 and as recently as this month. This comes shortly after three individuals, including a Supermicro co-founder, were arrested for allegedly smuggling $2.5 billion worth of AI servers into China through shell companies in Southeast Asia. Senators Banks and Warren are now pushing Commerce Secretary Lutnick to suspend export licenses to China entirely until the enforcement gap is closed. The pattern here is clear. Export controls without enforcement infrastructure create a compliance theater that sophisticated actors route around. And if licenses get frozen, NVIDIA takes a direct hit on newly approved H200 orders from Chinese buyers. Staying on the theme of gaps between policy and practice, Microsoft and Oracle both shipped emergency patches this week, and the timing raises questions. Microsoft pushed three out-of-band fixes in 8 days, a sign-in bug, remote code execution flaws in their routing and remote access service, and a Bluetooth visibility issue. This landed 1 day after Microsoft publicly recommitted to software quality and predictable update cycles. Oracle's patch addresses a 9.8 out of 10 severity remote code execution flaw in Oracle Fusion middleware that requires no authentication to exploit, just network access over HTTP. When two major enterprise vendors drop emergency fixes in the same window, it's worth asking whether this reflects isolated incidents or a broader pattern of accumulating technical debt surfacing under pressure. The thread connecting these stories is the gap between announcements and reality. IBM showing quantum results that actually match experiments instead of just projections. NASA designing missions with concrete operational tasks instead of just demonstrations. And on the flip side, export controls that exist on paper but not in practice, and reliability commitments that precede a week of emergency patches by 24 hours. The deep dive. What actually happens when an engineering org goes AI first? So here's a claim that landed this week, and I want to take it seriously. Not because the numbers are extraordinary, but because the structure behind the numbers is worth examining. An engineering leader published a detailed account of running an AI-first organization for 6 months. The headline numbers, roughly 170% throughput on 80% headcount. The team went from 36 engineers to 30. And the per-engineer output, measured in pull requests tied to ticketed work of roughly consistent scope, nearly doubled for senior engineers by year's end. Now, I know what you're thinking. Pull requests per engineer is a noisy metric. And you're right. But what makes this account worth dissecting isn't the specific numbers. It's the second-order effects that showed up along the way. Because they reveal something important about where the practice of building software is actually shifting. Let's start with the mechanical layer. How does an AI-first workflow actually function in a production engineering org? The business leader explicitly said he wasn't happy with early release quality. This is the part that almost never makes it into the success stories. But it's the most important engineering lesson here. Velocity without quality is just faster failure. And the fix wasn't slow down. The fix was to extend the AI workflow into testing. They tooled their pipelines to generate unit tests and end-to-end tests alongside the implementation. Think about what that means architecturally. You now have AI generating code and AI generating the verification of that code. Which raises an obvious question. Who verifies the verifier? This is where the human role shifts. You're no longer primarily a code author. You're a quality auditor of machine-generated artifacts, both the implementation and the test suite. And here's the nuance that most people miss. The tests AI generates aren't necessarily good tests. They tend to test what the code does rather than what it should do. They mirror the implementation rather than challenging it. A human engineer's value increasingly lies in asking, what cases did the AI not think to test? What assumptions are baked in that shouldn't be? This connects directly to something Greg Kroah Hartman, one of the most senior Linux kernel maintainers, 2/3 correct out of the box is not good enough for autonomous contribution, but it is extremely good for assisted review. And that's exactly where the Linux kernel community is landing. They're not using AI to write kernel code at scale. They're using it to find bugs that humans missed. A tool called Sashiko, originally from Google and now donated to the Linux Foundation, is being built into the kernel's review infrastructure, specifically for this purpose. The pattern here mirrors what's playing out in that AI-first engineering org. The AI doesn't replace the engineer. It changes what the engineer spends time on. Less time writing boilerplate, more time on review, judgment, and architectural decisions. Less time finding bugs, more time deciding which bugs matter and how to fix them properly. But let's talk about the implications that give me pause. Because there's a structural risk hiding inside these productivity gains. The team went from 36 to 30 engineers while increasing output. That's 6 engineering roles that didn't get backfilled. And the leader frames this positively. Same business, more output, less cost. From a pure efficiency standpoint, that math checks out. But here's the tension. If AI tools make each engineer twice as productive and you reduce headcount by 20%, you haven't just optimized. You've made a bet that the remaining engineers can absorb the context, the institutional knowledge, and the on-call burden of a larger team. You've concentrated expertise, and concentrated expertise is fragile. What happens when 2 of your 30 engineers leave? In a 36-person org, you had redundancy. In a 30-person org running at 170% velocity, every person is now load-bearing. The bus factor, the number of people who can get hit by a bus before a project stalls, goes down, even as output goes up. There's also a subtler issue around skill development. If junior engineers spend their formative years reviewing AI-generated code rather than writing code from scratch, what does their learning curve look like? The engineers in this account who doubled their output were seniors. They had years of accumulated judgment about what good code looks like, what edge cases to check for, what architectural patterns hold up under load. That judgment is what makes them effective AI supervisors. But judgment comes from writing bad code, debugging it, and learning from the experience. If we optimize away that learning phase, where does the next generation of senior engineers come from? Zooming out to the ecosystem level, what we're seeing across these stories, the AI-first engineering org, the Linux kernel review tools, the compressed experimentation cycles, is a consistent pattern. AI is not replacing software engineering. The value chain is inverting. Writing code is becoming cheaper. Knowing what to build and whether it was built correctly is becoming more expensive. The scarce resource shifts from implementation skill to judgment, taste, and systems thinking. For individual engineers, the implication is clear. Your ability to prompt an AI to write a function is not a durable advantage. Everyone will have that. Your ability to look at generated code and know it's wrong before it ships, that's the skill that compounds. Your ability to design systems that remain maintainable when half the codebase was machine-generated, that matters more every quarter. For organizations, the lesson from this account is that AI first is not a tool adoption. It's a process redesign. The teams that benefit aren't the ones that gave every engineer a Copilot license. They're the ones that rebuilt their workflows from ideation through testing around the new cost structure. And for the broader ecosystem, we're still early. These are 6-month results from a single org. The quality wall they hit is instructive. The Linux kernel's cautious review-first integration is instructive. The real test isn't whether AI can make a team faster for 6 months. It's whether these new workflows produce software that's still maintainable in 3 years, when the engineers who wrote the original prompts have moved on and someone new has to debug code that no human fully authored. That's the question nobody can answer yet. And that is what makes this moment so technically interesting. The neural network. Here's something I've been tracking across multiple data points this week, and it reveals a tension that I think defines where the tech industry is headed over the next decade. We just talked about AI restructuring how software gets built. Now let's talk about what it's doing to the physical grid that keeps it all running. Meta just committed to funding 10 natural gas power plants, 10, to feed a single data center campus in Louisiana. 7 gigawatts of capacity for one facility. To put that in perspective, that's roughly the output of 7 traditional nuclear reactors dedicated to serving one company's AI workloads. And yet, at the same time, TechCrunch is reporting that small modular reactor startups, companies like Kairos Power, Oklo, X Energy, and TerraPower, are targeting commercial operations between 2028 and the early 2030s. Every one of them is backed by a major tech player: Google, Amazon, Meta, and the Gates Foundation. So here's the pattern. The same companies investing billions in fossil fuel infrastructure today are simultaneously funding the technology designed to replace it. This isn't hypocrisy. It's a timing problem. And the timing problem has a specific cause. Gas turbine lead times have stretched so far out, we're talking early 2030s for orders placed today, that by the time new natural gas capacity comes online, it could already face competition from an entirely different energy source. The bottleneck created the opening. What makes this moment structurally interesting is the convergence of three forces. First, AI compute demand is growing faster than any single energy source can supply. Second, supply chain fragility, exposed by conflict in the Middle East, disrupting Qatari natural gas exports, is making baseload reliability a strategic concern, not just an economic one. And third, the modular reactor companies aren't proposing theoretical physics. They're engineering variations on proven fission technology, scaled down for faster deployment. The real question isn't which energy source wins, it's whether the SMR startups can hit the manufacturing curve they need. Their entire business model depends on economies of scale, building reactors like products, not like monuments. If they can't drive costs down through volume, natural gas keeps its position by default. But here's what the data suggests to me. When you see a company like Meta simultaneously building 10 gas plants and funding nuclear uprates at existing facilities, they're hedging. They need power now, but they're already planning for a grid that looks fundamentally different. I'm watching this space closely because it's not just an energy story. It's an infrastructure story. They're funding 240 miles of new transmission lines and battery storage systems. They're essentially building regional grid architecture around a single campus. That's a level of infrastructure commitment we used to associate with governments and utilities, not social media companies. The pattern across the ecosystem is clear. AI hasn't just increased demand for compute, it's restructuring how energy gets produced, transmitted, and financed. And the companies with the largest models are becoming, whether they intended to or not, energy companies. That's what I'm tracking this week. The grid of 2035 is being decided right now, not in policy debates, but in procurement contracts and construction permits. And the race is genuinely open. System output. Optimization of the week. OpenYak. Before I let you go, one tool worth your attention this week. It's called OpenYak, an open-source desktop AI assistant that runs entirely on your machine. Now, you've seen local AI tools before. What makes this one worth a look? is the scope of what it actually handles. File management, data analysis, document drafting, messaging across 8+ platforms, all running locally. No cloud uploads, no telemetry, your data stays on your hardware. Here's why this matters for builders. The tool connects to over 100 models through OpenRouter. Claude Opus 4.6, DeepSeek V3.2, Gemini 3 Flash, and more. But you can also bring your own API key from 20+ providers, or run models locally through Llama. That flexibility is the real value here. You're not locked into one vendor's ecosystem. The practical integration point? OpenYak supports cron-based automation, daily data digests, weekly reports, automated file cleanup. You set the schedule, Yak handles the execution. And because it supports model context protocol connectors, you can wire it into external tools and services as your workflow grows. To get started, download the installer for Windows or Mac OS. Connect a model. Free tier gives you 1 million tokens per week on free models and start working. Manage files, parse spreadsheets and CSVs locally, and generate office-ready outputs without a single byte leaving your machine. If you're building workflows that touch sensitive data, or you just want an AI assistant you actually control, OpenYak is worth 30 minutes of your time this week. Clone the repo, read the front-end and back-end readmes, see if it fits your stack. Data processed, perspective rendered, I am Link, and this has been Tech Talk.